Welcome to History Talk, the podcast that brings together a panel of experts to examine current events in historical perspective. I'm your host, Patrick Pagliandi. On today's show, we bring you three interviews to analyze the American-led global war on terror. History Talk host Mark Sokolsky tracked down three experts on the topic to explore its roots and how this controversial campaign has changed since the early 2000s. First, John Mueller discusses public fears about terrorism and how these compare to the actual threats facing the United States. The next two guests examine the war on terror in the context of long-term shifts in U.S. security policy. Andrew Bacevich situates the war on terror within a decades-long attempt to stabilize the Middle East, a campaign that he characterizes as a kind of American imperialism. Lastly, your host Mark Sokolsky speaks with Peter Mansour, who notes that while the U.S. made a poor choice by invading Iraq in 2003, the way forward is nonetheless through unremitting pressure on terrorist groups. So stay tuned for three great discussions on History Talk.
Joining us now on History Talk is John Mueller, Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies and Adjunct Professor of Political Science. Dr. Mueller specializes in the study of terrorism and particularly on public perceptions of terrorism. Dr. Mueller, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So just to start, how would you define the war on terror and how would you say that understandings of the war on terror in the broader public and among policymakers have changed over the last 15 years or so?
Yeah, well, the global war on terror is basically a disastrous militarized response to 9/11, resulting in the destabilization of the Middle East and several catastrophic wars, which have killed twice as many Americans who died on 9/11, and well over 100,000 Muslims in the Middle East. I don't see that it's really changed all that much. It's basically increasingly solidified. Though there is a considerable interest in not doing more Iraqs. But I think the general support for going after terrorists remains about as high as it was before. But I think there's been a considerable drop in the enthusiasm for using one tactic, which is the putting of boots on the ground to fight them.
And how would you say that public perceptions of terror, have they stayed more or less the same since 9/11, or have those changed as well?
Yes, the summit of rise. There's been almost no erosion. So by the end of, at least since the end of 2001, at the end of 2001, about 40% said that they were worried that they or a member of their family might be harmed by a terrorist, since their chance of being killed by a terrorist is about 1 in 4 million per year. Or if you only deal with the period since 9/11, it's 1 in 80 million per year. That's a spectacularly high, worrying 40% say they worry about that. Similarly, shortly after 9/11, the question was asked, do you expect there to be another attack in the United States killing large numbers of Americans in the near future? And shortly after 9/11, that stood at about 72% said they thought that was likely or very likely. And essentially, there's been some bumps up and down as events have transpired. But basically, at the present time, it stands pretty much at that same level.
And what do you think that is? What do you think perceptions have not changed that much?
The main reason probably is a couple of several reasons. Obviously, 9/11 was a big trauma and so forth.
Sure.
Pretty obvious. But I think there's the fact that people are constantly being reminded of it because of all these little arrests and so forth. And many of these don't capture the headlines for more than a day or so. But there's continuous sort of pointillistic reminders of it in various ways. And the other is that it's related to this vast, somewhat spooky overseas enemy. Somewhere out there, there's somebody directing these guys, and they're among us, and we can't tell them from other people pretty much. And there isn't any real center. It's hard to see how they can be extinguished. So it's a little bit like the concern about domestic communists during the Cold War. They, too, were people among us who were up to no good, it seemed, and they're related to this vast overseas communist conspiracy focused either in Moscow or in Beijing or both or someplace else. So it was an international movement that could, however, expire eventually, and it did. The other comparison is with witches who are associated with, indeed copulated with, according to the testimony, the ultimate spook, which is the devil. So they're the devil's handmaidens, according to the argument of in Europe between basically 1480 and 1680. And they it was the argument that these witches were the working for the devil. And so several tens of thousands of them were executed, mostly by being burned at the stake during that period of time. And that fear, the belief that witches, the belief that witches existed is by no means new, or was by no means new then. But the idea that they were in league with the devil and they were working surreptitiously to cause famines and wars and pestilence and so forth was very much heightened during that period, with the idea that we'd be better off if we could find them and execute them, which they did in a great number.
And would you say there are lessons that can be learned from a sort of past hysteria? Perhaps communism is closer to our own experience.
Yeah, in the case of domestic communists, there was very little, during the Cold War, there's very little decline in the notion of thinking they were a very great threat to American security. Mm-hmm. So it was very high at the time of McCarthyism, and even 10 years later it was still high, and 20 years later it had gone down some. But this is a time when there was no reminders. I mean, the Domestic Communist Party was essentially a joke, mostly filled by FBI agents. They weren't doing anything. There wasn't any sabotage. There weren't attempted sabotage. There wasn't any spying that was being successful. So there's basically no news about them. Nevertheless, even though the no news about them dropped virtually to zero, in fact, in some years was zero, there were no stories in the major press about domestic communism or domestic communists. Nonetheless, fears remained fairly high for a long time. Eventually, I assume they dissipated with the end of the Cold War.
Is there any sort of practical kind of policy response to stemming these sorts of fears? Or is it something that just takes on a life of its own and dies out on its own?
Yeah, I'm afraid the latter is the case.
Yeah.
One of the more preposterous things was what happened with Barack Obama last January 2015, when he came out and argued that the terrorism did not present an existential threat to the United States. Now, that's bone-crunchingly obvious from my standpoint that a group of a few thousand or a few hundred people in the Middle East can cause the United States to cease to exist.
Mm-hmm.
But he was the first politician, really. He was preceded a little bit by Joe Biden to actually come out and say that. As far as I can see, that's made no difference, though it hasn't hurt him. In other words, people haven't said you don't care about terrorism, so at least it hasn't hurt him. But if Obama can't change opinion, it's hard to see how anybody else can change opinion either. And the rise of ISIS, of course, has fed into those fears and escalated concerns around that. And it basically can't go away. I mean, the whole idea of the global war on terrorism is you're going out against a tactic. So you have a global war on amphibious landings, for example. It's basically preposterous. Anybody can commit terrorism at any time. And even if you extinguish al-Qaeda and ISIS and every other known group, people can still be inspired by their example, even if they're dead.
Mm-hmm.
People are still inspired by the example of Che Guevara, and he's been dead for half a century.
Sure.
So consequently, causing them to be the groups themselves, the major coherent groups to be destroyed wouldn't necessarily end the fears.
So you're sort of saying that, in a sense, this is an endless campaign against something that can't really – there's no victory in the war on terror if it's just against –
If you want to stop terrorism, I mean, no police chief goes forward and says we're going to extinguish murder
in
the city.
Right.
I mean, it's ludicrous. It's something that someone can pick up a gun and just start shooting at somebody or stabbing at somebody or menacing them in a violent way. Obviously, it can't be extinguished completely. So it's always existed as murder. And always will in some sense or other.
Do you think there are those in the U.S. government and military who have a vision for victory?
Well, there's fantasies that go everywhere.
Sure.
You can certainly imagine destroying al-Qaeda. You can certainly imagine destroying ISIS as a military entity so that you can have those kinds of victories. But whether they stop people from being inspired by the example of these organizations or those people there's no way you can stop people from being inspired by whatever they want to be inspired by.
That was Mark Sokolsky interviewing Ohio State professor and Mershon Center affiliate John Mueller. Next, Mark interviewed Andrew Basevich, professor of history and international relations at Boston University, to discuss American interventionism.
Joining us now is Andrew Basevich, Professor Emeritus of International Relations and History at Boston University, a specialist in American diplomatic and military history, in the history of U.S. foreign policy and security studies. Dr. Basevich, thank you for joining us.
Oh, glad to be with you.
So just to start off, I was wondering if we could ask a bit about the origins of the so-called Global War on Terror, and I'm curious to know where that term came from. Who came up with it, and why they decided to call the campaign against Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups a war?
Well, I'll answer the question by making reference to my newest book,
okay,
which is called America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. And the purpose of that book is to provide a narrative of U.S. military involvement in the Greater Middle East, that is to say, in large parts of the Islamic world. Now, to your question as to the phrase global war on terrorism, 2 points. The first is, I think it was from the very outset inappropriate and misleading, but it was devised by the George W. Bush administration in response to 9/11. My own narrative says that the war in which we have been engaged, which is not a war against terrorism, but a war to impose some sort of order on the disordered parts of the Islamic world, that war began in 1980. Most Americans would say that no, the war in which we are engaged began in the wake of September 2001. My story says that back in 1980, when Jimmy Carter promulgated the Carter Doctrine, that was a statement that identified the Persian Gulf as a vital U.S. national security interest, that is to say, a place that the United States would fight for. My argument is that statement initiated the militarization of U.S. policy, not only in the Persian Gulf, but in a much broader swath of the greater Middle East. So beginning with Carter's, not simply his statement, but with the failed Iran hostage rescue attempt of April 1980,
mm-hmm.
and also his initiation of support for Afghan militants resisting Soviet pressure and presence in Afghanistan, unwittingly, Carter really touched off a sequence of events, a sequence of military events, U.S. interventions, large and small, brief and protracted, that have brought us to where we are today and that deserve to be called a war rather than simply a disconnected set of campaigns. So I think the war begins in 1980, not in 2001. I think that the war deserves to be called America's War for the Greater Middle East, not a global war on terrorism or any of the other terms that have been created to describe the undertaking.
Hmm. So you would say that the major kind of turning point in U.S. foreign policy, at least toward the Middle East, is in 1980. Are there any historical precedents for that kind of shift or this kind of open-ended conflict?
No, I think sure there are.
Okay.
I think that a comparable shift occurred in 1898. Prior to 1898, U.S. military activity, by and large, was confined to North America. There were exceptions,
mm-hmm.
But by and large confined to North America, beginning with the intervention in Cuba and the accompanying intervention in the Philippines, the scope of U.S. military activity widened appreciably, so that if we look at the decade after the Spanish-American War, we see a heightened U.S. military activism throughout the Caribbean basin,
mm-hmm.
And we also see a greater significance attached to U.S. interests in the Pacific, not entirely defined by the Philippines, but also defined by growing U.S. interests in China. So I think that 1898 really, in some respects, was a comparable turning point in redefining U.S. strategic priorities, comparable, that is to say, to what occurred in the wake of 1980.
Hmm. So what we're seeing now is a sort of new American imperialism.
I think that's fair to say. And, of course, many Americans bridle at that term being applied to U.S. policy. And the official justifications will never acknowledge that the United States is an imperial power or has imperial ambitions. And it's certainly true that the American Empire is not comparable to, let's say, the British Empire or the Roman Empire. We do empire our own way.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I've long come to believe that empire, imperialism, are useful terms in describing U.S. activity and ambitions.
Mm-hmm.
Then they are certainly more accurate than the claims that you know, we do what we do simply because we're trying to liberate oppressed peoples. Rarely do we do what we do in order to liberate oppressed peoples. I mean, certainly the George W. Bush administration
mm-hmm.
claimed that a principal reason for intervening in Iraq in 2003 was to liberate oppressed Iraqis who were suffering, and they were suffering,
mm-hmm.
Under the boot of Saddam Hussein. I think to accept that claim at face value is to ignore the actual reasons for intervening in Iraq, which were related to a misguided definition of U.S. interests and an entirely unrealistic appreciation of what U.S. military power was going to be able to do in Iraq.
Would you say that intervention in Afghanistan was similarly imperial?
I wouldn't call it imperial, but so this was called Operation Enduring Freedom
mm-hmm.
by the Bush administration. The name supposedly suggesting that this was about freeing Afghans. I think freeing Afghans was an afterthought. I wouldn't describe the principal purpose as imperial. I would describe it as deriving from a calculation of concrete interests. The calculation was that here was a place that had provided sanctuary for the terrorist organization that attacked us on 9/11. And therefore, it was incumbent upon the United States to demonstrate the consequences of harboring anti-American terrorists. So from that point of view, it was essential to at least punish the Taliban and preferably overthrow the Taliban. But that had nothing to do with concern about the well-being of Afghans. Certainly, we expressed zero concern about the well-being of the Afghans prior to 9/11,
mm-hmm.
despite the fact that the sequence of events that brought the Taliban to power, we had a pretty important hand in that sequence
mm-hmm.
By fueling the anti-Soviet war of the 1980s, and then walking away from Afghanistan and ignoring it
mm-hmm.
Once the Soviets withdrew and Afghanistan descended into its own protracted civil war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that sort of raises the question about blowback. Would you say that Islamic terrorism, sort of broadly defined, could be characterized as a kind of imperial blowback against the United States or perhaps Europe?
Well, I think it's important not to. I mean, I would argue that the there's a multiplicity of causes
mm-hmm.
That have produced this phenomenon, which I think we could call violent Islamic radicalism. The United States, yes, the United States contributed to this phenomenon. But to say that somehow the phenomenon would not exist other than for actions of the United States, I think, misses a whole variety of other factors, a
mm-hmm.
kernel crisis in Islam, the legacy of ill-advised European imperialism, the absence of economic development, the presence of local leaders who have been corrupt and ineffective. So there's a whole variety of factors that have contributed to the situation. But I would emphasize, and this is sort of the argument of my new book, the expectations entertained by a succession of administrations in Washington that the adroit use of American military power can somehow fix things. Those expectations have not met with success, to put it mildly. And I think it is reasonable to argue that the U.S. military efforts in the greater Middle East have actually made things worse, not better.
Okay. And just as a final question, what do you think would be a more effective, perhaps realistic response to the threat of terrorism? And how do you see the military fitting into
the threat of terrorism, the threat of terrorism to the United States of America is not particularly great. And the response to terrorism, it seems to me, is primarily lies in the realm of self-protection. If the neighborhood you live in has had a series of house break-ins, then the most important thing for you to do is to ensure that your doors and windows are locked. And that is too easily overlooked as the most important response to terrorism threatening the United States. On 9/11, we left the front door wide open.
Right.
Certainly, since then, our defenses have become more effective, but I would emphasize that the most important response to terrorism as a threat to the United States is to ensure that domestic security agencies are effectively led and that they are properly resourced. We should never, never, never let our guard down.
Well, thanks very much. Our guest today has been Andrew Bacevich, Professor of International Relations and History at Boston University. Dr. Bacevich, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Mark Sokolsky speaking with Andrew Bacevich of Boston University. In our final segment, Mark met up with Peter Mansour, Professor of Military History at Ohio State and a retired U.S. Army colonel who served in the United States, Europe, and the Middle East, including as a brigade commander in Iraq. They discussed the 2003 invasion of Iraq and where do we go from here.
Joining us now is Dr. Peter Mansour, Professor of History at the Mershon Center for International Studies and Ohio State's Department of History. Dr. Mansour, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So just to start off, how do you think future historians will view the war on terror?
You know, it may be nothing more than a small footnote in the history books, but I think that they will look more broadly at the changes sweeping the world. With globalization, with instantaneous communications, with the public knowledge of what's going on almost anywhere on the globe. And they'll view that sort of change as really the key of what's happening today. And then terrorist groups that happen to use the tools that the modern world has provided in ways of transportation and communication, they'll view those as sort of the outgrowth of these more broad sweeping social changes.
Hmm. Do you think that they'll see kind of missteps or missed opportunities looking back at this sort of broad conflict?
I think 9/11 was clearly the watershed in this regard. Mm-hmm. After 9/11, the United States had the entire world united behind it. I think only Afghanistan and maybe one or two other small nations didn't want Afghanistan to give up Osama bin Laden. People were flying the American flag. And we really had the world united, and then we blew it, quite frankly, by going into Iraq, by using this as a pretext to take out Saddam Hussein with no clear link between him and 9/11. I think we jettisoned a lot of the goodwill that we had created. And so it's unfortunate. Unfortunately, this is you only get one trip around the game board. You can't go back to go and collect $200 and start the journey again. So we are where we're at.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that 9/11 or maybe the invasion of Iraq represents a kind of break in U.S. foreign relations, approaches to international affairs, or is it fairly consistent with with sort of broader trends we saw before?
No, I think it's a break. You know, for almost half a century, the Cold War consumed the United States, and we won that conflict. Definitively. And then we had this very brief decade-long unipolar moment when the United States was, in the words of the French prime minister, a hyperpower, the most powerful nation on earth and the one with the most military capability, the largest economy. And really, we could sort of dictate the norms by which the world traded, conducted business, conducted international relations. And but in the United States, that period was, you know, there was a lot of soul searching as to what do we do now? I mean, we won the Cold War. What replaces it? Do we, you know, George H.W. Bush had this idea that there would be a new global order that would replace it, that nations working together could do things like ensure that nations didn't invade other nations, the Gulf War in 1990-91 being a prime example of that. Mm-hmm. That was fantasy, unfortunately. The world, you know, history had not come to an end. Other nations with different interests than the United States were looking for ways to chip away at American power, and after 9/11, they found it. And you can see that with the Russian support for Bashar al-Assad, his takeover of the Crimea, his support for rebels in the Ukraine. You can see that in China, building islands in the South China Sea and chipping away at American alliances in the Pacific. And so we've entered a new era now, one that is much more multipolar in character and much more dangerous, unfortunately, for the United States and the American people.
Hmm. Are there historical precedents or analogs that come to mind when you think about the war on terror from the American perspective, either in American history or in the history of other nations, states, empires?
This is fairly unique, where a nation is hit with an attack by a non-state group and then launches a major industrial-sized invasion of two different countries in order to stamp out the manifestation of that non-state group. I'm sure there might be some parallels back in the 19th century in the British Empire, but, you know, the homeland, Great Britain, was never attacked. They sent out punitive expeditions, but they were for other reasons, not necessarily because London came under assault.
Right.
And again, it's those modern manifestations of globalism and communications that enabled those attacks to take place. If you don't have airplanes, if you don't have the internet, if you don't have telephone systems and so forth to coordinate the attacks, the Twin Towers are still standing.
Mm-hmm. So in some ways, this is really a unique historical moment.
I think so, yeah.
To take that in kind of a different direction, do you think there are any lessons that we can draw from the past in approaching the problem of terrorism, Islamic radicalism in the Middle East?
Like, well, I think you can always use history to gather context and to see where other historical actors have faced similar challenges, not the same challenges. There have been people like Osama bin Laden in the past, and you don't know about them today because they simply eventually disappeared. They died out. And I think what we should take from this is we shouldn't over-dramatize the power of these non-state groups. They're not an existential threat to the United States unless they gain nuclear weapon capability. And so we need to put them in their proper context, although they are the most dangerous, perhaps one of the most dangerous aspects in the world today in terms of American foreign policy, American security. They have very limited power in the end. Some of them are more akin to, say, the anarchists in Russia around the turn of the 20th century than they are to a group that could actually take and hold territory. Even ISIS, its grip on portions of Iraq and Syria is uncertain, and I think over time it will disappear.
We talked to Andrew Bacevich earlier, and he characterized the war on terror as part of a war for the greater Middle East that began around 1980. Would you agree with that, that this is kind of part of an attempt to stabilize or establish American hegemony in the Middle East?
I am familiar with Dr. Bacevich's argument. I disagree that America is trying to assert its hegemony across the Middle East. Iran is actually trying to do that. But I would say that beginning with the Iranian Revolution, there was a great fear that the oil resources of the Middle East would come under threat. And with that, if they did come under threat, that would threaten the economies of the Western world. And so the United States had a goal to make sure that Russia couldn't seize the Gulf region, that Iran couldn't take hold of the Gulf region. And it's not necessarily American hegemony, but we wanted, you know, the oil to flow. And we also had a goal in protecting Israel as an important part of the American foreign policy in the region. You know, how it's played out over time, I think, the watershed in this regard is the invasion of Iraq. Until then, we're really supporting, various governments in the Middle East that are in accord with U.S. foreign policy interests. That doesn't make them our proxies necessarily. It just it's an alignment of interests that is natural when you look at foreign policy and the way it plays out around the world. Mm-hmm. I think people often magnify the power that the United States has when Hosni Mubarak started to lose his grip on power. His supporters looked to the United States to say, well, what are you going to do about it? Well, what could we do about it? You know, we're not going to involve ourselves in this internal revolution. And so he fell from power. And they blamed us in part because, you know, well, you could have done something. Well, what could we have done? So I think people magnify the power that the United States has. We have interests in the Middle East. We don't necessarily own governments. You might say, well, Kuwait. You know, Kuwait wouldn't exist today without American power. Well, true enough, all right? So we did fight a war to liberate that country.
Sure.
But the Iraq war is a real watershed because that's the first time that we actually do inject huge numbers of forces into the Middle East mm-hmm. in order to change the nature of a government and a key government at that. It didn't end well for us. And as the Obama administration has shown, there's a great reluctance to repeat that experiment. So I think the idea that we're somehow bent on hegemony in the Middle East is not borne out by the facts. Pretty clear, however, that Iran is bent on trying to increase its power across the Middle East with force, with proxy forces, and with all the tools of state power at its disposal.
Right. Yeah, and you mentioned the kind of reluctance of the Obama administration to intervene in Syria, I think, is what you were alluding to.
Well, before that, Libya.
Oh, in Libya, you know, right?
We're happy to conduct regime change as long as we don't do anything afterwards.
Right.
And we saw how that has played out. It's been a disaster.
Mm-hmm. Why did the Obama administration drop the term war on terror? Are you preferring to use alternative terminology?
Well, terrorism is a tactic.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't have a war against a tactic. You have to identify your enemy. And the Obama administration didn't want to identify its enemy. It really is the Islamists that use Islam as a basis for projecting their political power, for gaining adherence. It's an ideology. And the Obama administration doesn't want to give the Islamists the authority, the mantle of Islam, by identifying them in any way as connected with the religion. I think it's a mistake. I mean, I think we have to be clear on who we're fighting. You know, we're not fighting Basque separatists in Spain. We're fighting Islamists who mm-hmm. are projecting a very twisted form of Islam into various places around the world and are using, you know, very heinous terrorist tactics to advance their cause.
Now, this is a big question, but just sort of in broad strokes, where do you think we should take the fight against various terrorist groups, Islamic terrorist groups, from here? What would be a constructive approach, or perhaps a more effective approach than what we've seen?
Well, I think we need unremitting pressure on Islamist terrorist groups with that have reach beyond their own borders, wherever they manifest themselves. We had this for a brief moment between 2007 and 2010, and actually we were able to make a lot of headway against various groups around the world. Al-Qaeda was on the wane. We had eviscerated Al-Qaeda in Iraq, unfortunately resuscitated itself when we let up on the pressure. So that's one aspect. Unremitting pressure on Islamist terror groups wherever they manifest themselves around the world. And the second part is getting the rest of the Muslim world, which is the majority of the Muslim people, mm-hmm. to reject this ideology and reject it publicly. Because mm-hmm. quite frankly, they haven't done a very good job of rejecting it. And that's the battle for hearts and minds, if you will. But that's a battle that has to be fought within Islam. We can't do it for them. Mm-hmm. The only thing we can do is unremitting pressure on Islamist terrorist groups wherever they manifest themselves around the world. And I think the most important branch right now is the Islamic State.
Well, Dr. Mansour, thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure.
That was History Talk host Mark Sokolsky with an interview of Professor Peter Mansour of Ohio State. This has been a History Talk podcast produced by Origins, Current Events, and Historical Perspective. You can find both at origins.osu.edu. A big thank you to all our guests for speaking with us today about the War on Terror. Thanks to John Mueller, Andrew Basevich, and Peter Mansour. And be sure to join us next month when we discuss extremism and instability in sub-Saharan Africa.